Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Amit Chatterjee to the broadcast. Amit is the CEO and founder of Hurrah, the fastest-growing provider of environmental and energy management solutions. Amit has been at the forefront of shaping a new category of business software and has championed the notion of organizational metabolism. Under Amit's leadership, Hurrah addresses an end-to-end environmental and energy business process from reporting to reduction across an organization and its value chain. Amit is a thought leader on green economy innovation, energy independence, and entrepreneurship, and was selected as one of the most influential people in business as part of Fortune magazine's 40 Under 40 list for 2010. Prior to founding Hurrah, Amit led SAP's fast-growing governance, risk, and compliance unit. Amit developed his strategic and leadership experience while at McKinsey & Company, working with clients such as SAP, Cisco, and Oracle. Amit has BA degrees in political science and chemistry from the University of California at Berkeley. I recently caught up with Amit in his office in San Mateo, California, and our conversation covered World-Class IT Principle 4, IT and Business Partnerships, as we discussed the role the CIO can play in communicating the value from environmental and energy initiatives to colleagues outside of IT, especially to the CFO, and we also covered an array of topics related to environmental and energy management. Amit Chatterjee, welcome to the Forum on World-Class IT.
Thanks a lot, Pete. Thanks for having me. It's always an opportunity to be able to talk about what we're doing.
Wonderful. Well, Amit, for listeners who may not be familiar with Hurrah, could you take a moment to talk a bit about your mission as well as a bit about the products and services that Hurrah offers?
Absolutely, Peter. Hurrah started in the notion that effectively natural resources are not visible to Fortune 5000 companies. That energy and water are reliable, invisible, and not significant cost-wise enough to really be levers of cost reduction. Hurrah believed fundamentally that energy equals EPS and that earnings per share would be able to be delivered. So when I started penciling out what the company could do, effectively I realized that optimizing natural resource utilization and minimizing environmental impact, while definitely great green ideas, were not enough to convince Fortune 5000s to come along. And what we decided instead to change our mission to was Hurrah helps organizations grow and profit while optimizing natural resource utilization and minimizing our environmental impact. The net effect was that what Hurrah wanted to do was identify a way for organizations to participate in the natural change around energy management and water management and waste management in a meaningful way that didn't compromise profitability. And that became a significant tenet for our organization to start to establish leading-edge solutions around this, both software and services. And no surprise, since our launch 17 months ago, we've now managed to respond to a number of customer demands across 90-some-odd countries for a holistic approach to energy and environmental management. The net effect is we've created a transparency where customers understand what their problem is, the size of their footprint, right? Is it the breadbasket or a barnyard in terms of energy consumption that they have on a global story, to actually all the way leading down to results and actually driving efficiencies. On average, Hurrah believes that anywhere from 5 to 15 to 20% energy reductions can actually occur by simply doing better management and behavior modifications. Hurrah has been able to attract more and more customers around looking at driving those energy costs and consumptions down, in addition to obviously water and waste. Let me tackle that last piece that you had asked about, which is the products and services. Hurrah's solution set, which includes software and services, is a cloud-based in essence around the product side, which is a Hurrah EEM product, which gives organizations auditable transparency and control of their organizational metabolism. Now, let me explain what I mean by organizational metabolism. Pete, when you normally think about being healthy, everyone always asks you, what's your BMI? Well, OMI is our version of helping corporations understand how successful they are around energy, water, and waste management relative to their profitability. And so by creating a number, we actually help companies identify where they've got fat in the system and what they can do about it and what's the most effective way for them to do this without compromising costs. The net effect is that obviously over time we start to see organizations shape up, if you will, and improve their OMI by using our software and our services to drive down energy costs as well as reductions in energy and water.
Excellent. Well, Amit, I appreciate you giving such a great and thorough overview. It's a very exciting business, clearly, that you're in, and what a space to be in during these times, as this is a topic that I know is front of mind to a lot of executives. Like many of our listeners and our past interviewees, you were an executive at a prominent technology firm. In your case, it was SAP. And while in your post there as the Senior Vice President of Governance, Risk, and Compliance, obviously, as is evidenced by the fact that you've now founded successfully this company and are running this company, you were bitten by the entrepreneurial bug. And I wonder, did the desire to run your own company come first, or did the idea come first? Were you hungry for an idea that was uniquely your own to pursue? Or did the idea simply occur to you, and then you were off and running with hurrah?
This is actually, Pete, this is my fourth startup that I've been affiliated with and associated with. So I've always had the entrepreneurial bug and do thrive to do a lot of this work. But when I was at SAP, I was in a relatively comfortable position, definitely seeing the market as enterprise software was consolidating, that SAP was one of the four, maybe five winners that we, you know, were going to come out of that. So there wasn't a lot of like, oh my gosh, do I need to change what I do? But it wasn't until I actually started being involved with a nonprofit organization called the Extraction Industries Transparency Initiative, where I got sort of, as you said, bitten by the entrepreneurial bug to really try and solve the energy and environment problem. And the Extraction Industries Transparency Initiative, just to give you a brief there respite on what they do, they're responsible for looking at how foreign direct investment impacts developing countries such as Africa, breakaway republics of the former Soviet bloc, in how they're now suddenly getting, you know, they have coal mines, they have, you know, rare earth materials, they have XYZ, and how foreign direct investment is impacting their financial structures and their government structures. At the point in time that we're obviously taping this, we're even seeing that happen in the Middle East in a much greater scale, where government corruption needed to be curtailed. And one of the important things that everyone felt was a driver was foreign direct investment. And one of the people that really sparked that was George Soros. He had written a paper and he had used Angola as the example there, where he talked about the diamond miners that are backing the rebels and the oil companies that are backing the governments. And then that led to a continual strife in Angola. And when I looked at that, I was impressed and excited about it. But then I also thought about that it wasn't just about foreign direct investment, and it wasn't just tracking the money flow that would really create change. What would really create change on a global scale would be that everyone understood its natural resource risk, right? If you produce 17 widgets and you realize that you're going to run out of water in 5 years, but if you actually produce 14 widgets, you would actually be able to have water around for the next decade. You might actually choose to make less product. And I felt a lot of companies didn't factor that into their equation in terms of the sustainability of their business relative to the consumption of energy and water that they were using. So it became obvious to me that there was an opportunity now to really create a nexus of where we brought software and transparency, generated results, and environment all wrapped into something that I felt I had unique experience to go out and do something about. And it wasn't just about being successful any longer. It was about trying to have a role where I was significant in the global story. Because I think you can be very successful in many routes, but rarely do you get to wake up every day and believe that you're not only being successful, but you're also being significant. And I think that really, at the end of the day, sealed the deal for me as to why I wanted to start this.
That's fantastic. And I think in listening not only to that response, Amit, but your first response, I think the only thing that seems like a disconnect is the fact that this business is less than 2 years old with all that you've done and the many products and services you're already offering, the many places that you're operating. And maybe you can take us a little bit through the process there. How did you go from that seed of an idea that was in your mind with the backstory you've just provided, some funding from various VCs, and ultimately now a going concern with business in 90 countries? How did you go through such a rapid expansion like that?
You know, it's interesting because I think Hurrah started out as a business idea that I had come together with, you know, after figuring out that there was something important I could get done. The question was the type of capital required, the type of connections to really be able to bootstrap this business and launch it in the right direction required something special as well. Because at the time when I was thinking about Hurrah, you know, you could say competitive landscape-wise, there were probably 150 mom-and-pop shops that did some form of either consulting or had an Excel sheet-based software product that really told that just did carbon reporting. And my vision was a little bit broader, but it also required the credibility to have to be able to work with a partner on the other side that could really afford us the opportunity to walk into Fortune 5000s at the most high levels and actually be taken seriously. And that was sort of how Kleiner Perkins became the sort of natural first partner for Hurrah. We basically built the relationship around, you know, its general partner base, right? And when you think about Kleiner Perkins, the first thing you think about is, wow, amazing infotech background. Sounds like they're going to nail the social networking background as well, given their recent investments. But also now you can see them starting to intertwine where they already had built out from 2006 or so, where they had really started to position and hire and retain some of the leading edge thinkers around greens. And fusing those two things, I kind of walked to them and I said, wow, infotech and green tech today merged. You know, there's a nexus of one kind of technology company that really could be unique, and that's what Hurrah can be for you. And I think they saw that, we saw that, and together it made us the right kind of partners to work with. So we got the seed funding together to get the company started. I hired a team around me, and we spent the first 12 months in stealth mode, basically working and focusing on really trying to get the customer in our mind. In other words, what they were thinking about and how we could really expand the story beyond just simply reporting, but to actually reduction. And I think it was at that point that we finally decided we need to come out with a product that we think is leading edge and that we think we can serve as many global instances. We launched in 2009, had an immediate pent-up demand for customers that drew down on the product quickly. At that point, I would say we went through our second phase of growth where suddenly having real customers on a technology system gave you certain constraints, right? We had to now rethink the product in terms of performance, scalability. We then began to build new service capabilities on top of this because customers didn't just want us to talk about the software and then leave them behind. They also wanted us to own part of the result. So then we had to start to build that out. The third phase of the company then went, we started having a lot of our customers not only work with us in their domestic offices, but start to say, you know what, I have 1,000 facilities across the globe. I need you to be able to work with this, and it has to be in the language of the country that it's operating in. So suddenly Hurrah had to release 7 new languages, had to have new functionality so that somebody operating, logging in from Brazil or Belize in, you know, IE6 Explorer, at the same time, somebody in Australia logging in and the latency and the demand time for them to be able to receive their information from a global place had to be well documented, well constructed, well architected. So what I like to say is, you know, we started with the innovation, we then invested in scale, and now we're back into innovation. And what happened in the final phase of where we are currently operating is that we've added new features such as supply chain, MRR reporting for utilities, and now really built out a business that has created new innovations where we've created an energy network for our customers. And that's allowed us to really be able to continue to evolve the business to the next level of need for customers, always continuing with the number one thing in mind, is that our customers are our best example of success. 100% of our customers are referenceable. Most of them are up and running within 4 to 6 weeks. And that's also then led us to our largest deal, which is Abu Dhabi Water and Energy Agency, where we're now taking on 250,000 buildings, over 1.5 million or 2 million records managed with inside the Hurrah system. Just a true new scale of demonstration that not only can you do this on a small scale, but that we can manage it to a global scale. And when you think about that Abu Dhabi Water and Energy Agency story, not only is it impressive from its performance and scalability story, but the net effect is we're going to hopefully abate 8 natural power plants, our natural gas power plants needing to be built, and saving anywhere in the neighborhood of $3 billion to greater over the next 10 years.
Extraordinary. That's a very impressive result, so to be sure. As you talk about your clients, I know they're often within the Fortune 5000 space that you mentioned, chief sustainability officers, heads of environmental or energy initiatives, CFOs. You've mentioned, of course, various municipalities, mayors of cities, and so on. What advice would you have for chief information officers who are looking to develop green technology strategies of one sort or another? I know that we have a lot of listeners who have dipped their toe in the water, perhaps even have very sophisticated mechanisms in place to help green their technology, so to speak. But what sort of benefits can an IT executive communicate to their CFO, for instance, that would provide the rationale for pursuing investments like what you're describing?
You know, there's a couple of our partners that are in the technology space, you know, that initially went in and tried to sell directly to the CIO when there wasn't a financial instrument linked to it. And CIOs are probably one of the more savvy executives because they've had to grow up through the internet era where we had a hodgepodge of technologies. They grew up probably through the Y2K era where you basically threw a bunch of consultants at a problem. And now what they've gone through over the last decade is figured out how to be efficient and consolidating their technology stacks. So by default, if you sort of look at a CIO's landscape of what they own from 2005 to 2010, if they did any sort of server consolidation, data center consolidations, application consolidations, odds are their energy footprint saw reductions. But secondarily, now as they start to think about technology refreshes, they can get even bigger energy savings. All of that, unfortunately, has not been credited to the CIO. They've allowed technologies justifications for the indirect benefits, but haven't actually claimed right to those hard cost benefits of energy savings. We've seen in the energy space now a shift away from the notion of sustainability to what I've coined flight to finance. This notion that in order for sustainability officers to be successful, they need to create a business case. Well, in general, when the CIO is starting to launch any business process in an organization, at some point has to be signed off by the CIO. This is an opportunity for the CIO and the CFO and the CSO to collaborate together and write a business case around the actual opportunity of technology-enabled energy reductions that are driving improved EPS for the organization. And I think that a key element always behind this is that the reliability of what the CIO has done for the organization is, he's created large, complex, scalable, repeatable, and institutionalized business processes. He can do the same thing here in this space. And today, many of the organizations just don't have that expertise, but the CIO is well endowed in terms of staff and budget to be able to establish a new business process that does drive cost savings, and that becomes something that I would encourage them to start from, which is how much cost do I want to take out of the system and where can energy fit into that model? And that becomes a very powerful lever over time for CIOs, and it's available for them to seize now.
That's great. And as you talk about this, you're clearly talking about real dollar savings that organizations can experience relative to instituting and implementing the kinds of products and services you're referring to. Have we reached a tipping point on environmental and energy initiatives across industries, do you believe? To what extent are there still hurdles that industries or organizations need to get over at this point?
No, you know, I think that energy is a challenging area. And, you know, I think there's two things that happen because of this. Number one, I think there's a tremendous amount of political tying to energy, you know, and people who come into this space come into it because either they're completely environmental or they're completely taking aside for the ability to continue to leverage coal or carbon-intensive processes. And they sort of sit at the boundaries of one another, when the reality is that the middle is actually, you know, the right ground to take here, which is that you can actually get cost savings by doing smarter things. And energy efficiency, which is sort of the domain that Hurrah plays in, it's not sexy. It's, you know, there's no flash fuel cell to this. It's not something you can hold in your hand. It's not a shiny solar panel. But in the end, it actually saves significant amounts of dollars. And it allows us to create a bridge economy around energy from the point of where we are with the carbon-based business processes around driving energy to now moving into something where alternative energy technologies can actually be economically competitive for Fortune 5000s to consume on a grand scale. Right now, what we have is we have pockets of deployments around really great ideas, but they haven't hit scale. And part of that is the technology needs to continue to develop. Part of it is they need to figure out their scalability. But the bridge in the middle is that there are thousands of things that customers can do that are driven by government rebates, that are driven by tax incentives, that are driven by just smart things with low CapEx, right? A lot of our customers will do work and they'll try to ask, what's the minimum that I need to put in? And, you know, frankly, the minimum could be $50,000. If you run the right employee program, you could probably knock off $250,000 to $500,000 without blinking an eye. Those kinds of energy efficiency programs drive down tremendous amounts of cost. There was one study done by the DOE that actually said that if we fully deployed energy efficiency across the entire United States, we would actually flatline the 2005 levels of energy usage for the next 10 years, which would basically mean that we would allow the alternative energy technologies, the breakthroughs such as shale gas exploration, to really come to fruition without impacting, without us having to continue to build out more and more coal plants, which we all believe is no longer sustainable. So when I look at this, I say, you know, there's so much left, and we've probably scratched the very, very top surface, you know, sort of top 5%. And the reason for that is the technologies of where they are today. We need to make this transition. But in addition, you know, let's be honest, right? If energy has been in your face and you actually saw somebody shoving coal into your building furnace every day as you walked into work and when you left work, it would be much more visible. Electricity is generally reliable and invisible and has never had any real constraints as your utilities have continued to serve you. Now, as they're starting to reach capacity and we start to deal with a world where we have regular mandated blackouts during peak usage hours, people will start to question that. And then once that's at hand, we'll have an opportunity now for people to start to say, geez, could we be doing something different? And the holy grail behind all of this is, let's look at some of how we do what we do on a regular basis, and can we do that differently without impacting the final result? And I think when people look at that, they'll find a lot of inefficiencies in energy, that much like in the 90s when internet ran across all of the other business processes, supply chain, how you sell, how you design a product, how you deal with outsourcing. The internet played a great role in transforming that. We often joke that energy missed the internet era. It has not leveraged that technology at all in any meaningful way. And now there's an opportunity for us in the next decade to write that story, but also give alternative energy technologies an opportunity to enter the economy in a delayed fashion when they're probably a little bit stronger and healthier.
Makes sense. You mentioned, Amit, that the government has offers rebates, tax incentives that potentially allow organizations and individuals to see the benefits of this. But you also mentioned at the outset of your answer there that there's a loaded element, obviously, to have the government involved, the political aspect to this. What role do you see government playing? And is it more help or hindrance because of that kind of balance between the elements we just spoke of?
Well, I mean, you know, when you think about government, you know, I think people have two reactions to that, right? Government has to be the complete solution to everything, or that government needs to stick out. The fundamental reality is that when you break down what we need at the energy level, there's at least somewhere between $500 billion to $1 trillion of infrastructure investment that over the next couple of decades needs to be deployed across this country to actually achieve energy independence. I don't see private companies or regional utilities figuring that out. That has to be a government mandate. That has to be driven down, and it has to be a prioritized investment, because otherwise we will run into significant issues of just being able to power our stories. Our future can look like Central London, whereas Central London today, it's physically impossible to actually deliver any more energy to Central London. So they are left with one strategy and one strategy only, which is keep energy efficiency a priority there. And so I think the government has to fix the bigger problem. I think when it comes down to some of these other issues, you know, that's fundamentally to me an economic decision that every Fortune 5000 or every municipality needs to deal with on their own, which is how do we want to participate in this emerging grid? And what is our role, what is our strategy going to be around that? And I think if we head down that strand, we actually take care of the what I like to call the equivalent of rolling out Route 66, right? So the government rolled out Route 66. They built that roadway. But did they build all the mom-and-pop gasoline shops? Did they build the general stores? Did they build the fur-trapping areas? No. Those were entrepreneurs that looked at the scenario and said, geez, Louise, this would be great. I'm going to put a diner here because I know where the gas station's being put up. And these weren't massive Fortune 5 companies at that time. These were mom-and-pop shops that purchased gas, right? You know, they didn't get into this space. And it's the same thing that can happen here. Is if the government will focus on the biggest problem, which is the infrastructure, then that allows entrepreneurs and corporations to understand their role in that story and now be able to participate in a more direct manner. Oftentimes, everybody boils it down to pricing carbon. A lot of times, what it can be is without the price of carbon, you can have innovation because the infrastructure has been invested in. And even if there's a predictable story around what the investment would look like, most organizations can begin to act without the carbon story in there. But I do believe that when the carbon story happens, that will be a price point that then will accelerate a lot of the developments that we've been waiting on.
Very interesting. But can you look into your crystal ball for a moment, Amit, and tell us where you see this space in, say, 5 years' time?
You know, I've always started the notion that Hurrah's big, hairy, audacious goal, to steal a quip from Jim Collins, is that there's roughly 4 trillion kilowatt hours being consumed in the United States. Somewhere in the neighborhood of 1.5 trillion kilowatt hours is the commercial and industrial world. And I believe there is an opportunity for Hurrah and the type of software that we deliver to capture anywhere from 50 to 80 billion kilowatt hours in the next 2 to 3 years, and possibly even up to 200 billion kilowatt hours in the next 5 years. And by taking that kilowattage and managing it and reducing it, that gives Hurrah an opportunity to be able to say and point to real reductions around kilowatt hours. And then that means that we've then abated the need for needing to build another power plant, but waiting for alternative energy technologies to catch up. And I think that that is probably the best effort that what we can do is that we've been able to capture over time trillions of kilowatt hours and help the country move forward with energy infrastructure that allows us to keep up in GDP growth without compromising the environment. And I think that's a great message that our company rallies around, because I know that, you know, we wouldn't need to want to go through this hard work of trying to convince people why energy equals EPS.
Well, that's fantastic. It's exciting to hear you talk about the short history, but tremendous opportunity you've already seized, Amit, and it's certainly exciting also to see your vision for the future. Thank you so much for joining us on the Forum on World Class IT and sharing your ideas.
Great. Thank you very much, Peter. Pleasure to be on.
Listen to a podcast in a series we call MetaStrategy's Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategy's 5 principles of world class IT. The 5 principles are as follows. Principle 1 is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the 3 prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy-setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The 5th and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the 4th principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information about these 5 principles and sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metisstrategy.com. And please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metisstrategy.com. Our editor is Chris Davis, and our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.